Canadian-state immigrant relations continue to be marked by unnecessary, violent, U.S.-style raids and deportations. Within at least the last 7 months, hundreds of migrants throughout southern Ontario, including Simcoe, Toronto, Leamington, and Windsor, have been aggressively confronted at gunpoint, handcuffed, incarcerated, and deported, as well as denied due process. All the while, an understanding of why so-called illegal or non-status peoples are a product of a broken Canadian immigration system has not been explored, and authorities refuse to lay charges against any of the employers of the arrested overseas workers, instead preferring to target the most vulnerable people. In response to these recent raids that have been occurring under the public's noses, there have been many public actions throughout Canada, including in Guelph, Ontario, denouncing these dehumanizing attacks on racialized, working poor immigrant communities. Formerly known as Student Support for Migrant Workers, Fuerza Puerza, meaning strength in Spanish and Tagalog, organized a potluck dinner and panel held on April 30, 2009. In downtown Guelph. The potluck, titled Status for All May Day Dinner, featured speakers from many different associations. Here is the recording of the panel.
And so Student Support for Migrant Workers organized this event to demystify the government and mainstream media's attacks on immigrant communities, and especially in the last 2 years, and including the latest in raids, arrests and detainment and deportations of over 100 migrant workers in the southwestern Ontario area. Throughout the evening, we will learn about the tremendous changes that have taken place within the Canadian immigration system, and including with the changes within the last week. And these changes are shaping the Canadian immigration system to mimic the U.S. immigration system policies and the treatment of newcomers, including documented and undocumented workers. This information is lacking in public dialogue and resulting in the lack of public demand to end these racist attacks from the federal and provincial governments. And demanding these dialogues on these issues must be at the forefront of the political agenda. So we have three speakers today. Our first speaker is Jan McLaughlin. She is a medical anthropologist. She is teaching sociology and anthropology at the University of Guelph, and as well international development. She's conducted several extensive research with migrant farm workers in Canada, Mexico, and Jamaica, focusing on human health and human rights. Though she has been involved in a lot of number of voluntary initiatives, including solidarity with migrant workers, including a recent pilot project in order to provide specialized medical care to migrant workers. And she's also my professor, which is very cool. Awesome. Very cool.
Extra marks then.
Yeah, A+.
Marks have passed though. Okay. Our second speaker for this evening is Marco, and he's an organizer with Migrante Ontario. Migrante is an alliance of organizations that work for the rights and welfare of migrants, and focusing on doing advocacy work with Filipino migrant workers in Ontario through various initiatives such as education and training and advocacy. Migrante Ontario works to educate, organize, and mobilize Filipinos in Ontario, and working to unite other Filipinos in Ontario as well, and is part of a global network of migrants' rights and welfare advocacy and global-based organizations. And our final speaker for tonight is Craig from Nona Legal Toronto. Nona Legal Toronto is an advocacy group for people without status in Canada. Nona Legal demands an end to all deportations and detentions, the implementations of a full and inclusive regularization program for all non-status people, access without fear to essential services for all undocumented people, and the recognition of Indigenous sovereignty, an end to the exploitation of temporary workers, all imperious wars and occupations, and an end to use of the security certificates and secret trials. Another special guest is Benny Quay from the International Students Advisor at the University of Guelph. And as well, after our speakers, we have a Q&A session and as well a documentary after, so you guys are welcome to stay and continue enjoying our food. So without further ado, thank our speakers for coming here. So. Janet, so please take it away.
Thank you so much to Student Support for Migrant Workers for having this event. I think it's a really important event and I'm really happy to be here. My name is Janet, and thank you, Andrew, for the kind introduction. You will get an A+ if I was still grading you, but you're no longer my student, so I'll have to remember that for next time. These are some flags of some of the migrant farm workers' countries that work around the Guelph area. Does anyone know where some of these countries are. Mexico, Jamaica, someone said, yeah. And the other two?
Guatemala,
yeah. And Thailand. There's a bunch of nationalities that are now employed in agriculture around Guelph. And I just picked a few of the main ones. But today I'm going to be speaking mainly about migrant farm workers that come to Canada from Mexico and the Caribbean as part of the Seasonal Agricultural Workers Program. This is the topic of my PhD research, so it's what I know the best, but I'm going to try and contextualize it a bit with a wider discussion of migrant workers. So we started off the night with this image. This image actually came from The Economist, of all places, and if you can believe it. So you know if The Economist is parodying the situation in this way, that we've got a problem in Canada. Migrant workers are showing up, and they're being exploited in a number of ways, and I think we'll hear about that from a number of different perspectives tonight. So just to highlight a few recent headlines for you tonight, we've first got the firing of a number of workers from Rowland Farms. This happened in December, just before the new year. Then we have stories about the economic downturn and temporary foreign workers being the first people to be laid off in this downturn. Then we've got the issue of farm workers being unable to unionize in Ontario, and there's been a lot of recent arguing back and forth in the courts to try and get them this right to unionize. Now we have issues over a number of workers being deported, and this is what actually prompted tonight's event to talk about these recent raids on immigrants. And now we have the flu outbreak leaving Mexican workers in limbo. This is, as you've probably heard, I don't know if any of you have heard of it, it's kind of an obscure media story. There's the swine flu going around. You may have heard of it if you're really in tune with things. You'll probably hear more about it in recent days. But this has really affected Mexican workers, and particularly as they're coming into Canada, they're now being screened and doubly screened at the airport. And no other immigrants or permanent residents are being screened in the same way as these migrant farm workers. So all in all, 2009 has been a pretty crappy year for migrant farm workers, and this is just a few of the headlines that give you a sense of what they're going through. But I should say that until recently, very few people were even aware of migrant farm workers being in Canada. So the fact that we're getting this media attention is the direct result of a lot of groups bringing awareness and attention to the plight of migrant farm workers. They've been an invisible population for the most part over the past 42 years that they've been coming to Canada as part of this program. So I'm going to give you a little bit of a context. That's what academic types do. To try and figure out how did we get to today and these recent headlines. So just to put this all in perspective, Canada started off, as you know, in a problematic way with European people coming here and taking the land of the indigenous people, and then coming up with the idea of its own imagined community, being basically white European people that could immigrate without much problem. And so from the very beginning, we have differentiated white settlers from people of color. And this goes right back to the Chinese labor that came to build Canada's railways on unequal terms with Canadian society. And then in 1947, a number of contract labor programs emerged. And this was to bring in migrants from countries that weren't deemed worthy of being immigrants to Canada, to do labor in specific industries and then be sent home again when they were no longer needed. Initially, they were admitted under the category of visitors, and in 1966, a program called the Seasonal Agricultural Workers Program emerged. And I think we'll hear more about the Live and Caregiver Program a little bit later, but this was also emerging. And these were later integrated into this program called the Non-Immigrant Employment Authorization Program, through which migrant workers could come to Canada, work for a period, and then be sent back home. So as you can see, this has a long history in Canada. This has since become the Temporary Foreign Worker Program, which we now have been hearing a lot more about. And this program has been rapidly expanding, and there's a number of people who've written a lot about this if you're interested in learning more. But this is just the basics, so if you're being tested after, this is the historical trajectory. So here's a picture of the very first group of Jamaican migrant workers. The program started off between Leamington, Niagara, and Jamaica. And if you'll notice about something interesting about this photo, most of the migrant workers in this photo are wearing suits and ties. And that's because at this time, They were told they had to look their best and be on their best behavior to get these important contracts for Jamaica to be able to come to Canada. And the program was set up that these workers could come for a maximum of 8 months. They would work in the seasonal firm industry, and then as soon as the season was over, they would be sent back home. Some of these workers who I've interviewed and who I work with as an advocate have been coming to Canada for 3 or 4 decades, and still they're not allowed to immigrate. They're only allowed in seasonally, and they must return home afterwards. And the founding of this program was very much based on racism. It was very much based on the sense of, well, we want the Caribbean workers in here because they're hardy and they do the good work, but we don't want them to immigrate. And so it's very important to recognize the racist undertones of this program, which have never been addressed, and this program still goes on like this. So over the past decade, temporary foreign workers have risen exponentially in a whole number of industries, not just agriculture. In fact, there was a 122% increase over the past decade. And so this is a really big increase, and more our economy is integrating people from the global south in particular to do the jobs that many Canadians are refusing to do under conditions which many Canadians are refusing to endure. Okay, so I'm going to focus my comments today on this one program, the Seasonal Agricultural Workers Program. This program, as I said, started in 1966. This graph shows from 1978 onwards. This has been sold to the Canadian public as a temporary migration program due to temporary seasonal labor shortages. But as you can see, the demand for these workers is permanent, and it's only continuing to rise. Nonetheless, still we recognize these people only as worthy migrants, not as worthy immigrants. And the immigration point system is set up so that it's very difficult to become an immigrant to Canada, and only certain groups of people can do so. The SOP, as I'll start referring to it, this is the handy-dandy acronym, is a very complicated program. It's run between various governments. There's employer organizations, and I won't even get into it, but it's a complicated program with various people involved. And one thing that happens in this type of a situation is that when something goes wrong, everyone passes the buck and says, well, that's someone else's responsibility. Because there's so many jurisdictions, local, provincial, national, multiple governments, and there's not one overseeing body that makes sure that workers' welfare is protected. Now, this program is extremely important for Canadian agriculture, and I certainly want to emphasize this. And I'm going to emphasize today in my presentation some photos and some quotes from people I interviewed, particularly migrant workers. But in this case is a quote from a farmer who basically is saying that migrant workers are the backbone to the agricultural industry, and if the program was dropped, there are a lot of farmers that would just go under. And that's absolutely true from many farmers' perspectives. If they didn't have this source of labor that could come in the day that they're needed and leave the day that they're not needed and work as many hours as they are asked to, it would be hard for them to compete, because on a global scale, agriculture is set up everywhere with these very exploitative labor relations. And so because we're in a globalized economy and farmers in Canada are trying to compete against farmers in many other countries, they argue that they need this kind of a program in order to survive as an industry. From migrant workers' perspectives, they continually state that migration is increasingly necessary to support their families. They say things like, it's necessary for someone in every family to migrate. And these are from Mexican workers, but you'll see similar sentiments from workers in countries like Jamaica, certainly in countries like the Philippines, that rely heavily on migration. So increasingly in this global economy, as more and more farm workers in their countries of origin can't make ends meet, they are relying on migration as a way to support their families. And this worker here is discussing how even though all of his family works in the field all year long, in the end they can only earn about $2,000, and that's simply not enough to support their family. So someone has to migrate. And this is leading people to migrate through channels like this program to Canada, where they come legally. It's also leading people to migrate without legal status. And it also leads people with legal status in these programs to sometimes, once they're here, not go home at the end of their contract, especially if they're worried about losing their future employment. Because each year, the employers need to request these workers back. And if they don't request them, they can't come back. And if they're worried they're going to lose their job, perhaps they're sick and they don't feel like they can pass the health exam, or perhaps they've had a fight with their employer, then often they will simply leave their firm, and then they go into from being a legal migrant to being someone with precarious immigration status. So when we see the raids that are going on today in firms, it's quite likely that a number of those farm workers were actually here initially legally through this program and then stayed on and then became quote-unquote illegal, as the government is phrasing. So it's important to recognize the connections between these various systems. But in the end, everyone's migrating to support their family in this very unfair global economy. So migrant workers, these are a few images of homes that migrant workers are building up in Mexico and Jamaica. And they consistently say that without this money, it would be very hard for them to build these homes and to support their families. In Canada, too, if you go to rural Ontario, obviously we're surrounded by rural Ontario, but especially the regions where these migrant workers congregate, you'll notice things changing, Mexican restaurants popping up, flags coming on outside of people's homes. Some cases, migrants even bringing in cactus plants from home to try and remind them of home and to enjoy a nopal here and there. And so these are the images that are changing in the social landscape. Now, I want to take you through exactly how this program works. I think it's kind of interesting. I had the really amazing opportunity through doing my doctoral research to do research and activism with workers in Canada in the summer, and then in the winter go home with them to Mexico and Jamaica and hang out with their families. So it was really a great project. And so here are some images from going back home with them. This is the Ministry of Labor, where workers apply for the program in Jamaica. And there's hundreds of workers who want to come for each position that there is in this program, so it's very competitive. And here are the image where workers go to apply in Mexico. And below are the images where the government officials work that administer things. So right from the get-go, you can see the workers apply in kind of the rough part of town, and the government officials work in really nice air-conditioned offices. And here's an image of actually inside the Ministry of Labor in Jamaica, where workers are coming to apply for their job. And as you can see, they're just waiting and waiting for the one moment that they can come up and apply. So Canada is seeking mainly male migrant workers, and Canadian employers can determine the nationality and the gender of their workers. And the Jamaican and Mexican and other countries can go through and stipulate further things. In Mexico, for example, they're only looking for men who are married with lots of children and single mothers, because they want to ensure that migrant workers have a family to support and that they'll go home at the end of their contract. And if they have a family, it's much more likely that they'll do that. And so many of Canadian employment equity laws are blatantly violated by these practices. First of all, we're selecting based on nationality, based on gender. 97% of the participants are men, almost totally excluding women. We're basing on family status, age. So several layers here of discrimination that wouldn't be allowed if it occurred in Canada, but because it's occurring so-called offshore, it's allowed to happen. Here are some images of workers' files being processed in Jamaica. And workers must go through a thorough 2-day medical exam every year before they can come to Canada, to ensure that they're fit and healthy to work on the firms, and also to ensure that they don't have any health problem that will imply that they need to use the Canadian healthcare system and drain the dollars out of the system for Canadians. So every year workers go through these quite thorough exams, and if there's anything wrong, they don't come back. Now, farming is a very dangerous industry. There's a high level of illnesses and injuries. So of course, if they get injured or ill on the farm, and they can no longer come back because of that illness or injury if it shows up on the medical exam. And so in this way, Canada can use migrant workers who are very healthy, make them sick, and then not take care of them once they're sick. That's the basic underlying premise of what's going on. So here we are sending workers to Canada. They're on an airplane. They get shuttled from the Ministry of Labor in Jamaica on this white school bus from the ministry to the airport where they're then given their passports. The whole thing is very much regulated. They arrive at Canadian airport, then they're taken off to a special room, further processed, and then shipped off to their firms. And this is the most any of them will see of Toronto. Pretty much they're confined to their rural areas. Many of them work 7 days a week. They have very little social contact outside of the firm. Many of them don't speak English. There's very few community integrations. So there's a number of issues that come up for these workers. Now, I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the consequences of this kind of migration. And here are some images of migrant families who've lost loved ones, who've died in Canada, who I visited when I was back in Mexico and Jamaica. Workers are really vulnerable to health issues and to a number of other concerns, principally because of the structure of the program. First of all, they can't stay in Canada after the contract is over. They can't become citizens. What does that mean? It means if they get sick, even though they're entitled to health care while they're here, they'll just be sent home where they don't have the same entitlements. They're not citizens, so they can never vote, and they have very little political voice in Canada. So it's hard to ever change the system because they have so little voice. They can't change employers without permission. Any of you who work or who study know that if you're stuck with a bad employer or a bad professor, for that matter, you want to be able to switch, right? If you're not being treated well, if you get into an argument, these workers don't have that right. It's difficult for them to change employers, and they're essentially bound to one employer. In some cases, they're able to change, but it's difficult. If the employer decides to fire them and send them home, what they call repatriation, there's no appeals process. So they can be fired, and a lot of workers have had this happen. Let's say they complain about something on the job, the employer will come in and say, here's a ticket, you're going home tomorrow. And there's no appeals process, and the worker's on the plane the next day. And I've heard so many cases of this happening, and it's very difficult because then workers are out of the country and they can't access any support systems here. And workers in Ontario can't bargain collectively as part of a union. This has been a long-going dispute, and they're still not able to. So all of these factors combined make workers in this program extremely vulnerable to abuse. Now, of course, I should emphasize that many Canadian farmers are very good employers. There's a wide spectrum between poor treatment and good treatment. But the point here is that there's no protection against bad employers if you're stuck with one. So this is what is really problematic about the program, that you can be stuck with any employer and you don't know if they'll be a good employer or a bad employer. And it's just hard to change that situation. So one worker describes being in this program like being treated like a disposable machine. He says, there are some bosses that are good, but there are other bosses that are totally horrible. The well-being of their workers doesn't interest them. Why don't they take care of their workers? That is the question I ask myself. I guess we're like disposable machines to them. They work us hard until we wear out, then they replace us with others. And this is the kind of metaphor that I continually hear from workers being worked hard 7 days a week, 12 hours a day, and then when something goes wrong, the next person's on the plane to replace them. And so it's very difficult to have any power in this situation. And this is exactly what this worker says. You have to be there to do what the boss tells you. If you start to disobey him, you will no longer return. For that reason, one has to accept everything. Although you know that it is not the correct thing or that they are committing injustices against you, you have to allow it. So in this context, there are a number of health issues that emerge, and here's just the quick gamut of the main issues that rose in my research. I won't get into too much detail, but basically a lot of occupational health issues, a lot of mental health issues around feeling very depressed in these situations, and even issues like unsafe transportation, like bicycle accidents, because workers are on poorly equipped bicycles, rural dark roads. Every year some of them are hit and killed in this situation. Their living environments vary widely. Here's a good example of a nicely maintained house, and then you have very poor examples, and it's very difficult. For example, in this picture you can see bunk beds just crammed together. There's no privacy, there's no space. And in this picture, you'll see an award that the workers won for keeping their house clean. At the same time, there's a sign here that says that there's a security company that's been hired to monitor comings and goings from their residents. And if they have visitors after 9 p.m., they will revoke the privilege of ever being able to receive visitors. And this is the kind of thing that happens. It's paternalistic, and it's kind of a combination of summer camp and prison. And because migrant workers live on their employer's property, employers can make the rules. They can say whether workers can receive visitors, whether workers can go to town on their free time. And I've heard of cases of workers being fired because they did go to town on their free time. So not only is their work life strictly monitored, but also their social lives are strictly monitored. So in this situation, workers are concerned about being isolated. They have no transportation to access the necessities of life. They have to rely on these poorly equipped bicycles. Many of them have language barriers. Many speak of concerns of racism. They have very little control over their situation at work and at home. They have this sense of being disposable. They have a lack of job security. There's no guarantee that they'll ever be invited back. And they have these long separations from their families. They're not allowed to bring their families with them. And these are parents with children in almost all cases. And so these are very painful separations. And there are situations where workers might have a loved one very sick at home, and they can't go home to be with that loved one because if they leave the program, they might not be able to get back in. So here are some images of workers missing their families and some images of families missing their parents. So there's a lot of effects and consequences at home as well. Now, in terms of the recent raids and people losing their jobs, I want to talk a little bit about what the consequences are of losing that employment. When workers go home in this kind of a situation, first of all, the reason they're here is because there are few economic opportunities at home. They're typically going home to a place where they don't have a job. Their families were depending on that regular income. They may have been sending a child to school, paying for someone's health care. When they unexpectedly lose this income, it's extremely difficult for the families. Workers in this situation often fall into a sense of worthlessness and depression. Sometimes it leads to addictions like alcoholism. And these situations can create a lot of family strain. So it's not just a matter of losing a job, it's a matter of a whole host of other effects that happen. And this is a worker here who's holding up the shirt that he was wearing when he fell off a farm vehicle, and he was very badly injured. This worker, because of the injury, couldn't work, was sent home, lost his job, and 2 years later, he's still not able to work. His daughter has had to drop out of school because he couldn't pay the fees. The wife is now working in the farm just trying to make ends meet. And then a hurricane hits the island, the farm is wiped out, and these people are just trying to survive. But there's no social security from Canada, because even though they pay into employment insurance, they're not able to access the benefits, because they go home and they lose their job. Okay, so I've painted a pretty dismal picture, and I know we're in pretty bad times as it is, so I want to try and cheer you up with a few hopeful messages to end the presentation on. It's not all bad, there are some good things happening, there's change in the air, and I'll end on the more optimistic note of highlighting a bit of those instances. So in 2001, there was a labor uprising of a group of Mexican workers in Leamington who were protesting these poor conditions. And this got the attention of the labor movement and social activists who went to investigate. And after this, they held a meeting. This is the poster from that very first meeting that was held. And many workers came to this meeting and they discussed the issues that they were facing. And this started a whole number of groups and organizations forming together to advocate for farm workers' rights. And here's a magazine from 2002 when farm workers, the union was going into Leamington and setting up a center for the first time there to support the migrant workers. So I based my research in the Niagara region, and in that region alone, there's a whole ton of these groups that have been really active supporting Caribbean workers, Mexican workers, and some of them are focusing on political advocacy and change and activism, while others are providing spiritual support and social support, organizing soccer games, things like that, to make workers feel more welcome in their communities. And these groups have made a really large impact. And here, as they were at a conference on migrant workers, and their Facebook page was highlighted at the conference. It was a very proud moment for the group. So I encourage you, if you haven't checked out this Facebook page and joined this group, do, because it's the group that organized our event tonight. They're doing great things. One of the things this group helped out in was a dinner that we put on for migrant workers in the Guelph and Kitchener region. And this is the working center in Kitchener where we held a dinner for them over the Christmas season. You'll see a lot of Guatemalan workers came to this dinner. Another event I've been involved in are healthcare clinics that go out to migrant workers and provide them health services in Spanish or whatever their language is, and at the hours that they're available and with or without a health card. And we're always looking for volunteers, especially Spanish speakers, but anyone is welcome. If you're interested in that, talk to me after. The Caribbean Workers Outreach Program is a spiritual group who's done a lot of work providing support, church services, community events. This is a young couple who started the fan club. They get together fans and they distribute them to migrant workers who are otherwise suffering from heat in the summer without ventilation and fans. So, you know, even the most basic things like this can make a big difference in their lives. And this group also goes to Jamaica each winter and visits the migrant workers and tries to maintain that community. Then there's Justicia for Migrant Workers. This is a political advocacy group. It has a very extensive website. If you just Google it, it'll come up, highlighting a lot of the issues I've been discussing. We focus on political activism at the local level, provincial level, and national level. The focus of Justicia is to empower workers to fight for their own rights in whatever ways that they can. So rather than Justicia dictating the terms, the workers come up with their own concerns, and Justicia acts as allies to help them promote those concerns to the government. Justicia also conducts workshops on various issues for workers, and they assist them to access the benefits to which they're entitled. The UFCW, the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, has set up a number of support centres throughout rural Ontario and other regions of Canada. They've been really monumental in helping workers to access benefits. They also have helped migrant workers just, for example, attend medical appointments when they need a translator. They provide workshops as well. And they've also been issuing a number of legal challenges to try and fight for change. So, for example, farm workers were excluded from the Occupational Health and Safety Act. The UFCW has been appealing that. Farm workers have been excluded from EI, even though they pay into it. So for a while, the UFCW is fighting for workers to not have to pay EI. And most recently, the union has been fighting for workers' rights to organize. And I'm going to briefly mention a little bit about that, and this is one of the final things I'll discuss. So I was asked to kind of give you a brief overview of the history of the unionization and the attempt to unionize. I'll just start off in 1994. Briefly, we had an NDP government in Ontario that allowed them to unionize. 1995, the Harris Conservatives came in, removed that right. 2001, the Supreme Court ruled that this ban on farm unions was unconstitutional and ordered the provincial government to table new legislation. This new legislation gave farm workers the right to associate but not to unionize. Now, the 2004, the union took the province back to court. 2008, the Court of Appeal again ruled in the union's favor, saying that farm workers do indeed need to have the right to unionize. And now in 2009, the provincial government has appealed that to the Supreme Court. So now we're again in this limbo where migrant workers still don't have the right to unionize in our province. Basically, I'll sum up by saying the impact of these movements has been really helpful, but ultimately the constraints of this program are such that these groups can't make fundamental changes until the fundamentals of the program are changed. So I'll leave you with that. Here are two websites of these two groups if you're interested in more information. Thank you so much for your time.